morning, everyone.
Today we have the new issue of Invocation. It's up on the table there. You can take it as you go out.
My shirt matches the book, maybe.
On page 52, you will see a very brief description of a happening that we're preparing to take place in this hall next February as part of Auroville's 50th anniversary celebrations. It's a project called Savitri Around the World. And the idea is we are attempting that there could be a live reading of the whole of Savitri, going from starting in Pondicherry and going around India and then moving with the sun westwards through as many countries as possible and ending up in Auroville before the birthday. So there's an email ID here that if you are willing to participate in that, we need all kinds of participation. We need people who are ready to read wherever they may be. And we need coordinators. In several countries, there are centers. Those centers could coordinate the readings for their country. And especially, we need technical advice and help. So anybody who has that kind of expertise is please asked to contact us so that we can make it a smooth event. There'll be a big screen up here, and we hope to be able to see all the readers around the world as they read. Let's see whether we can pull it off or not. I think we stopped on page 9, am I right? Page 7. Mm-hmm. Which line is it, Pono? Oh, yes. So we'll start reading again on page 7, line 229. Inflicting on the heights the abysm's law. We are reading about Savitri waking up in the early morning of the day when she knows that Satyavan must die. And Sri Aurobindo is making us feel how she, a divine being who has sacrificed her divine state to take a human birth, to uplift humanity, is at this moment, as she looks back and remembers everything that has led up to this morning, she is feeling anguish. The anguish of the gods who are imprisoned. She is imprisoned in our transient human mold, the deathless, conquered by the death of things. She has accepted to bear the human lot under the grip of ignorance and death. But now she's facing this great ordeal, and it seems as if her sacrifice has been in vain. And we are reading about how Earth nature responds to the touch of the divine and the eternal. Sri Aurobindo tells us a little higher up, line 221, hard is it to persuade Earth nature's change. Mortality, the state of being in the grip of death, bears ill the eternal's touch. It fears the pure divine intolerance of that assault of ether and of fire. It murmurs, it complains at that sorrowless happiness which the eternal offers, almost with hate. It repels the light it brings. It trembles at its naked power of truth and the might and sweetness of the absolute voice. There's something in our humanity which recoils and shrinks away from that offer of sorrowless happiness and immortality. Will you start, Poonam? Thank you. So it here is earth nature. Anybody would like to share anything about this passage? Well, it's the splendid name of the messenger. There have been so many messengers, divine messengers who've come. We revere their names, but we find it very difficult to follow their example and their vision and their teaching. During their lifetimes, they've been very inspiring, and they've touched a certain number of people. A few have responded, caught flame, and risen to a greater life, but that response is limited. It's not very widespread. You have an image of popcorn to warm up. Everything starts to pop.
Yeah, just a few at a time.
A few at a time. All the corn pops.
All the corn. Well, you're lucky it's a message.
Yes. It's a very nice image for the transforming effect of the divine light. I have a slightly different image, but it's similar. It's about trying to light a fire with the help of a magnifying glass. Focus the sun's rays. Hopefully you've got a little bit of paper and you can focus that on one spot. And we don't see what's happening, but what's happening is that on that spot, the molecules are heating up and getting more and more energetic. And suddenly they burst into flame. And then the whole piece of paper will burn, and with that you can light your fire. So I think something like that is supposed to happen in Auroville, that the light is focused on this spot here and the molecules are supposed to heat up. And if they heat up enough, then it can have a transformative effect on a much wider. There are a few left. Yes. Anyway, that's the idea of a few catching flame and rising to greater life. But how far, what is the effect on the mass? No, I think it is heaven's messengers in general. No. This is what earth nature does. They come from the heights, they bring their divine nature, and earth nature inflicts on them the law of the lower lates nature. They, as long as they are here in a human body, they have to obey those laws of physics and the laws of human nature. No? So heaven's messengers come, they are pure, they're bringing their gift, but the earth nature just dirties them, throws its dirty mud at them. And it protects itself, it puts out its thorns. Those of you who know Saint-Exupéry's beautiful little book, The Little Prince, will remember how worried he was about the beautiful rose that he loves, that he's left alone on his planet, And he says, she's only got her thorns to protect her. No, she's all alone. So that's how we are. We put out our thorns so as not to receive that touch of the eternal. We injure the Savior hands of grace. And there are examples now of how earth nature meets the sons of God with death and pain. So they come like a glory of lightnings. For a time they cross the earth scene, but then the wonderful sun thoughts, these divine, powerful, inspiring thoughts they have brought with them, are fade away. They get darkened by our ignorant minds. And their work, what they came to do, gets betrayed. The good that they offer really gets turned around and perverted and is turned, used for evil purposes. A fire has come and touched men's hearts and gone. A few have caught flame and risen to greater life. Well, certainly Sherbindo and Mother were aware of what happens to the messengers and what happens to their message. They were very aware. They had no illusions about that. But still they were concerned to spread their light, their grace, use their Savior hands as effectively as they possibly could. Sri Aurobindo fortunately says in a letter that it isn't. he says the cross is a symbol of the resistance to the divine evolutionary principle that is offered by the material world. But of course we can't help thinking of the cross on which that was... there's also the crown of thorns and all this, yes. The messengers. Yeah. So the cross, the resistance, and the resistance causes so much suffering. No? So that is what Savitri is experiencing at this moment. It's this resistance. Satyavan must die. And Satyavan, to save Satyavan, is the mission that she's come to earth with, to uplift humanity. Now this seems hardly possible at this moment. But then he explains somehow how this process works. You would read, Ravi?
To online the world, she came to help and save. Her greatness weighed upon his ignorant breast, and from his deep presence welled a dire return. A portion of his sorrow struggle for to live with grief, to confront death on her road, the mortals lost became the immortals share, thus trapped in the gene of earthly destiny, awaiting her audience hour abroad, outcast from her inborn felicity, accessing life's obscure terrestrial road, hiding herself even from those she loved, the Godhead greater by a human faith, a dark foreknowledge separated her from all of whom she was the star and stay, too great to impart the peril and the pain. In her torn death, she gave the grief to come. As one who watching over men left behind,
left blind,
takes up the load of an unwitting race, harboring a foe whom with her heart she must feed. Unknown her art, unknown the
you. So there's earth nature, and then there's Savitri's nature. In her nature, she's too unlike the world she came to help and save. There's a big difference between them. So it's as if the earth nature is revolting against that. It's as if it feels a great weight pressing down on it. Her greatness weighed upon its ignorant breast, and it wants to repel that. And if you squeeze something, then if there's anything liquid there, it will come up more. So it's like that. Her greatness is pressing on the material nature, and from all kinds of dark cracks and crannies, something comes up, a terrible return, a response. She has to accept a portion of the sorrow and struggle and fallen aspect of earth nature. And this expresses itself by the fact that she has had to live with grief, and she has to confront the fact of death on her human journey. This is the lot of the mortal. None of us can go throughout a whole lifetime without having to live with grief and confront death on our road. This is the mortal's lot. So she's accepted. So in this way, trapped, caught in the jinn. A jinn is a terrible kind of man trap that landowners used to put them about in the woods on their properties, so that if any poor villager came to get a rabbit or some bird's eggs for his family, he would get caught in that trap. They were terrible things. They could break a person's leg. And then you'd just be stuck there. You'd have to wait. You'd have to wait until the gamekeeper came and opened the trap and took you to your ordeal. Then you would have to face the magistrate and the sentence that you are given. It could be capital punishment, or it could mean sending to Australia or whatever. So. Yeah, well, that was also pretty horrible, no, to those penal colonies in Australia. So it's like that, like a poor man, helpless. She's caught, trapped in the gin of earthly destinies, and she's just waiting for the hour of her ordeal, confrontation, which she's going to have to face. And she's lost contact with her inborn felicity. She's been cast out from that state of bliss which he described earlier, no? The proud and conscious wideness and the bliss, the calm delight that weds one soul to all, the key to the flaming doors of ecstasy. That was the nature that she had brought with her, but she, at this moment, she's cast out from that inborn felicity, and she's accepting to be just human, life's obscure terrestrial robe. And she's hiding herself, her divinity, even from those who are closest to her. And Sri Aurobindo says she's the Godhead, the divine individual who's becoming greater by accepting a human fate. It's just a hint which he elaborates on further on in the poem. Is that where we stopped? No? We went further? So, but I think it's clear, no? She's keeping that grief in her torn depths. She's suffering a great deal. Did we really read this?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, yes, okay. So this is a very interesting image. It seems like an allusion, as if Sri Aurobindo is referring to something, but I don't know what he's referring to. It's like somebody who has been left, who's a survivor, who has to look after a whole race or nation or group of people who've suffered some terrible disaster and they've lost their power of vision, they're left blind. And he has to take up, that one person has to take up the full responsibility for guiding that race of people who are unconscious, unwitting. Savitri is like that. Of course, the unwitting race is the human race. And that race that's left blind, it's us. She's carrying the whole responsibility for the human race. And at the same time, she is carrying within her, harboring a foe, an enemy, and she has to feed that enemy. It's gnawing away at her heart. And nobody knows. Her act is unknown. The doom, the terrible event that's coming, that she's facing, nobody knows about it. There's nobody to help her. Unhelped, she must foresee. She knows. It would be easier if she didn't know. She has nobody to help her with that foreknowledge. And she feels all the dread of this thing that's coming. And she has to have the courage to face it. Unhelped, she must foresee and dread and dare. This tremendous courage which Savitri shows. I think I have heard that this is one of the characteristics that Sri Aurobindo appreciated and influenced him to take Savitri as the heroine of this poem, of this great work he was embarking on. She has strength, but she has... Sorry? Because she's accepted to become a human being, to face the things that human beings have to face. Yes. It's a little too easy to think that God's messengers just float down and wave a magic wand and make everything right. It's not like that. They have to deal with what they want to change. Sorry? Yes, yes. Yes, even Christ, no? Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me? Yes. So going through that experience of feeling absolutely helpless. Human beings have to do it, no? In a way, those can be blessed moments when we've passed through them. But at the time when we're experiencing them, that is an ordeal. And people all over the world are facing that kind of ordeal today. I know of one family here in Oroville. They feel absolutely helpless against a terrible fate. Nobody seems to be able to help them. So that's why she had to take all this load on herself in order to attempt to change it. Yes, abode means to... There she is. She can't move. To abode means to stay, to remain. She's in the trap. She can't move. She can't escape. So now he's going to elaborate on Savitri's feelings on this morning as she wakes up. Will you read? Yes. It's the image of something eating away at your heart. It reminds me, I don't know whether Sri Aurobindo intended an allusion here or not, but it reminds me of a story of the Spartan boy. The Spartans were a city-state and city-nation in ancient what is now Greece. They were the rivals of the Athenians. And they, unlike the Athenians, they were not so interested in culture and beauty and all that. They were warriors. And their children, boys and girls, were taught to, their education was to make them very hardy and courageous and resistant. So the story that I'm vaguely remembering is about a Spartan boy who has found a baby fox and he puts it inside his shirt. And then, I don't know, he meets his family or his mentors or people unexpectedly, and he has to keep that fox hidden, otherwise he knows he will be punished, or they will kill the fox, or I don't know what, little fox. But the fox is a fox, and it's going on gnawing away at his chest. Does anybody else know this story? Claude, no? Yeah, you know this story, no? Yeah. And it's only when he really starts bleeding then they see that. There's a similar story in the Mahabharata. I won't go into that now. But what is that like, you know? There's something there, it's your enemy, it's destroying you, but you can't help it, it's just eating away at you. Nothing to be done about it. In Savitri's case, it's the grief, the pain, the foreknowledge. And she has to face that alone. Nobody is there to help her. We can read on. Thank you. So for a long time she's known that this day would come, that this morning would come. Now it has arrived. The long foreknown, fatal morning, the morning that's bringing death, it's arrived. For her this is a very momentous and special day that's different from any other day. But in another way, it's just like every other day to everybody else. No? It brings a morning that's just like every other morning, because nature just moves on her way. She doesn't care. She's not concerned when somebody has to die, or when a life is given up. No? She just moves on her way. Only human beings notice. And he says, God sees everything. Even the fall of a sparrow, Jesus says. So here he tells us that she's suffering from despair, even in this moment of her soul's despair, when she's got this appointment, this grim rendezvous with death and fate. She doesn't utter any cry. She doesn't ask for any help. She doesn't tell anyone about her trouble. She doesn't even show it in her face, in her actions, in any way. Calm was her face, and courage kept her mute, like the Spartan boy who wouldn't cry out when the fox bit him. Somebody wanted to ask something? Larry, yes. Only human beings notice, marks, it means notice, pays attention. And God's all-seeing eyes also notice. Is it clear? Yes, of course. Nature is collaborating. Of course, Mother said that on a special occasion, long after Sri Aurobindo had written this. But nature is the force of the divine. But she's moving on her way in a particular way that's been given to her. So nature, when we think about nature, her task, she doesn't have to care about every little ant that gets crushed underfoot, or every human being who dies, or every star that goes nova. No, she has a bigger task to pay attention to. But here he points out that human beings note it. And I do think this is important. For us, death is significant. We can think about why. For us as individuals, even if we hear about deaths of people that we know nothing about, but we hear that dreadful things are happening in Syria or Iraq or North Korea or wherever, no, there's something in humanity that responds to that. Man notices, even if we can't do anything about it. And he says, God notices. He notices everything. I hope it can be. That's what I'm looking forward to. And I've heard of people, I have heard of people here who were in Oroville who were accompanying their partner when they passed, that it was really a spiritual experience. I've heard of that. Yes. You felt that, you had that, yes.
Very strong.
Yes.
We were talking, they were saying
what they were experiencing.
Not expressing one word.
Was that what you meant? But it's not like that for everybody. People die in agony, no? And without reason. And some people have the ordeal of foreknowledge. They know that they're going to be executed tomorrow and so on. Yes, Marie-Ange, you wanted to ask something? No. You've both got your fingers up as if you want to ask something. Oh, somebody behind. Whoever has something to say can say it now. Yes, Dana Lakshmi, Ganga Lakshmi. Yes. So this would be actually a very important experience for us all to have. Amal, my teacher Amal, spoke to me about this, the importance of knowing that your essential being survives independently of the death of the body. Yes.
Yes.
Everything changed, yes.
It must affect me, I meet you, I change, exactly.
Yes.
Also in the life, I have a test. Somehow.
Yes.
I have a test in the life, but I speak out and I do that.
Yes.
And now it is a critical. But nature. Some fox come and go down and
you.
On the end of death, the death of ignorance.
Yes, exactly.
Because I just wanted to mention that this thing about not complaining is, you know, complaining is a kind of little death. It's a psychological death. I've observed in the news these youngsters, these refugee children who are trying to get to Germany, how they have to suffer. They fight with the police, and every night they try to get on the truck to get there. But they never complain. They never get bitter or angry.
Usually complaining to help to keep it existing, so it's better to keep some.
Yeah, they get the inner strength that carries them through.
So this is now what's going to come. How could Savitri be like that? How could she have that courage and steadfastness? Not to give the slightest sign of this intense suffering that she's facing. No? That's the next sentence, Paula.
Yet only her outward self suffered and strove. Even her humanity was half divine. Her spirit opened to the spirit in all. Her nature felt all nature as its own. Living within, all lives she bore. Aloof, she carried in herself the world. Her dread was one with the great cosmic dread. Her strength was founded on cosmic heights,
might.
Cosmic mights. The universal mother's love was hers, against the evil at life's afflicted roots. Her own calamity, its private sign. Of her pangs, she made a mystic, poignant sword, a solitary mind, a worldwide heart, to the lone immortal's unshared work she loves.
Thank you. Well, the outward self is feeling all the things that human beings would feel, but she's got this inner being which is supporting that outward self.
She's not showing herself.
Yes. And according to what we've been reading in the Life Divine recently, that's really what we're all supposed to develop, no? This inner being that can support the outer being so that it becomes the acting center of our life and our work.
And the Life Divine builds that, I think when we read it, builds that in the strength of identity. I want to mention this line on 277, all lives she bore, she carried in herself the world. The other day, when we went up to, on March 29th, we went to the guest house where Mother Trevino met. I read beforehand that prayer she wrote that morning, before she met Shirabindu. And as I recall, it's something to the effect that she says, to thee I entrust our destiny. I felt like this time when I walked up those stairs, I tried to remember that she was carrying all our souls. She says, may the weakened souls be strengthened. So she was carrying us,
yes,
humanity's souls, up to and laid it at his feet.
Yes.
That it's a new dimension of the meeting.
Yes. It reminds me, these lines remind me of a line of Sri Aurobindo, which occurs in slightly different forms in two shorter poems. One is a sonnet and the other one is just another short poem. He says, I carry the sorrow of millions in my lonely breast. It was written in the late 30s and the sorrow of millions in my lonely breast. This identification with the life of it. And he refers to all the terrible wars that were going on at that time in China and in Spain and elsewhere. And I can hear, I feel the bombs bursting, and I'm carrying the sorrow of millions in my lonely breast.
And at the same time, he gave the antidote. I was reading in the Madhava Pandit's books on the Life Divine this morning here in the library that Sri Aurobindo started writing the Life Divine.
So that was around the beginning of the First World War.
Yes.
And it first came out in one volume in 1939.
Yes.
Second World War.
Yes.
So very few people knew this book at that time, but.
Yes. Sword.
So a sword is
a warrior's weapon.
So
instead of being weakened, allowing herself to be weakened by her pain, she makes it into a weapon. And that weapon she's going to use to fight the evil that's gnawing at the afflicted roots of life. It's the image of the tree of life. I think it comes from Nordic mythology, the tree Yggdrasil. But it's an amazing flourishing tree. But eating away at the roots, there's a worm, there's a dragon. So that's what she wants to destroy. Her pain is her personal sign of the universal suffering. And that's what she wants to change. Against this evil of life's afflicted roots. She's going to use this pain as her weapon to make her strong enough to destroy that worm.
I'm just thinking the Indian image is exactly opposite. The Ashwati tree, the roots are above.
Yes, that's right. That's
so
right. But this lower life, definitely it has a lot of affliction at its roots. We shall read about it later on. In book 2, canto 7 and 8.
But this mystic poignant sword is also very practical. Just on Friday, Sadhguru was reading from this Life Divine, where Sri Aurobindo says that philosophy is meant for living. It's not just for knowledge.
Yes.
So, and then he told that somebody asked Sri Aurobindo what to do when he couldn't sleep at night. So Sri Aurobindo said, read the Life Divine.
Send you to sleep immediately.
The two sentences that fall asleep.
One paragraph. No, one paragraph of the Life Divine gives you good sleep. Same thing. Everybody
said once, and we said, yeah, that's true. It's called sleep, take Life Divine, it's a book. Try it to believe.
No, it definitely works. That's actually why we read in a group. Because if you're just reading quietly at home, there comes a point where it doesn't go in anymore, and then you're asleep. No, one way, even if you're only half asleep. But somehow to read in a group and to exchange about the lines, that helps us to be more alert and more conscious of
it's
what.
It's also
we're
the time of the day.
Of course, the time. You don't fall asleep.
How do you conduct a Life Divine class? Is it like this, that everybody reads, or you only are reading?
We take it in turns to read, but since we only read, we read paragraphs instead of small passages like this.
Yes.
And since the paragraphs are quite long, we normally, on maximum, it would be three, or if they're very short, there might be four paragraphs that we read in the class. So not many people get the chance to read. And because the text is really difficult, I always try to select people who can read very clearly and can understand the text as they're going along.
And then you have a time of reflection?
Then everybody has the time, as we always take the time in this class, to reread the whole paragraph silently to themselves. We take quite a long time for that.
And then any questions or comments?
Then questions or comments, and usually then I run through the whole paragraph, bringing out the salient points, then questions.
But
Yeah, he was a scholar. Yeah. And yeah, yes. No. That's a wonderful thing, no, to take that whole book into yourself. Yes. And many other books of Sri Aurobindo's also. Yes.
The power is in the sound, isn't it? In the sound of the word. So you really don't even matter if you understand or not.
Helps if the sound carries some significance into your inner being. Into your inner being. Sorry? More than that, we started in December 2008, and we might finish maybe next December 2017, maybe 9 years. Shall we go on? I think it would be nice if we've reached the end of the canto today. Yes. So, Savitri is a solitary mind. She's apart. She's not sharing her thoughts with people. A solitary mind. A worldwide heart. She's carrying the whole world in her heart. And when she will get up on this morning, she will be getting up to the unshared work of one of God's messengers, of an immortal being. And now Sri Aurobindo is going to describe the process of her waking up. It is so wonderful. You can see whether it strikes any chords in you about your own waking up. Don.
First, life breathed not in her burden rest. On the lap of earth's original somnolence, inert, released and forgetful, prone to repose, unconscious on minds alert, obtuse and tranquil like the stone of a star, in a deep cleft of silence, fixed two realms, she lay remote from you.
Thank you. Sorry? Obtuse has two meanings, a physical meaning and a psychological meaning. The physical meaning is an angle that's more than a right angle. So it's not a sharp angle, it's a blunt angle. So if somebody's blunt in their understanding, you may accuse them of being obtuse. You're stupid, you don't understand. Unconscious, unknowing. So here, he's describing the state of the life in Savitri's body. No? It's not remembering, it's not grieving. No, it's lying asleep as if on the lap of our Mother Earth in that original sleepy state, somnolence of the unconsciousness of matter. Inert. So it's allowed to forget. Otherwise it would be remembering. But in that unconsciousness, before waking up, The life is just lying flat, prone, unconscious, on the verge of mind. The mind hasn't woken up yet. It's like a stone or a star, a piece of matter which has no feelings, no understanding, obtuse, tranquil, calm, undisturbed. It's such a beautiful description. And so it's as if she's in a deep cleft, a valley between two realms, the realm of waking, and perhaps we can say the realm of inner awareness, of dream, of sleep. She's between those two. And there's no grief. She's far away from grief. That care which is sawing away at her heart all the time, it is not felt. She doesn't remember, or the life in her doesn't remember anything about the sorrow that she's feeling here. That's the first state before beginning to wake. And then the stages of waking up are described. Marie-Ange. Thank you. It's almost like at the beginning of the poem, at the bottom of page one, in that blank, empty, neutral state, something moves. Here it's just a slow, faint remembrance moves like a shadow. And the body responds, recognizes the pain that's there, the close and lingering ache. It's been there for a very long time, deep, quiet, old, made natural to its place. But there's no consciousness there. She doesn't know why it's there, where it has come from. It's just a recognition. It's almost like that little first movement of aspiration, something wanting to wake up, longing for light and not being able to find it. So she doesn't know why it's there or whence it came, because the power, the inner power of consciousness that kindles, that lights up the fire of our mind, it's still not there. It's still withdrawn deep within. And the servants of life, the senses, the mind, are unwilling to wake up, like servants, no? Who have no wages of delight. For them it's no fun to wake up. They know they just have to work hard. Wages with no workers of delight. They feel sullen. They're unwilling to get moving. So this fire, this light of consciousness of the senses, it doesn't want to start. So she's not becoming aware of her environment, of any of the sense sounds or sights around about. The unassisted brain, it hasn't got the mind, the power of lighting mind, the sense power. It doesn't have any help. So it doesn't remember anything. It doesn't find its past. Only the body is supported by the vague, earth nature, just the life force of a human body. It's kept alive by that earth nature. We read one more passage, Amal.
But now she stirred, her light shared the cosmic glow. At the summons of her body's voiceless call, her strong, far-ringing spirit traveled back to the yoke of ignorance and faith, back to the labor and stress of mortal days, lighting a pathway through strange symbol dreams, across the ebbing of the seas of sleep. Her house of nature felt an unseen sway, illumined swiftly were life's darkened rooms, and memory's casements opened on the hours, and the tired feet of thought approached her doors.
Thank you. When she moves, when her body moves, sharing the universal life, that's a summons. That's a voiceless call from her body to her spirit, which has been far away. Strong, far-winging spirit. It hadn't been clinging to the body. It has been somewhere else. No? But when the body moves, then the consciousness comes back. You might notice something like this happening. So when that strong, far-winging spirit travels back, in her case, it's back to this human state, back to the yoke of ignorance and fate, back to the labor and stress of mortal days. But on its way back from wherever it has been, it lights up a pathway. There are dreams, there are scenes, things are noticed on the way back. No? This might happen to you as you wake up.
As a matter of fact, tomorrow, and you want to be training your consciousness during sleep, one of the moments that you can go back in your dreams is not moving your body.
Not to move the body, yeah.
And go slowly
back. Yes, not only in time, but in subtle worlds. No? We can go to all those subtle worlds, and our spirit can go to those places in sleep. And perhaps some symbol dreams may remain with us, giving some small indication of some of the experiences we've had on the way. It's very interesting about sleep. Mother says the reason why we need to sleep so many hours, it's just so that our spirit can get back to the origin and spend a few moments there before the body will call it back again. But that's what keeps us alive. It's that contact, even if it's only very brief. Yes, the body needs it, yes. But if we were in contact with our origin all the time, then the body wouldn't need so much sleep. Mother and Sri Aurobindo themselves hardly slept at all. Yes. Of course not. No.
Totally not.
Yeah. So then when the strong, far-winging spirit comes back, then The house of nature, the body, feels it. It feels this rule of the spirit coming back. And then all these dark rooms, the lights go on, memory comes back. Memory's casements, the windows open on the hours she remembers, no? And thought comes back. Tired, heavy feet of thought come back to her doors. So it's like a house, no? The body is a house. It's absolutely still. Nothing is moving in the house. Then there's a little movement. And things start to stir. The servants know they should wake up, but they don't want to. But that little movement is enough to remind the far-winging spirit, the inhabitant and master of the house, to come back. And when that consciousness enters, then everything lights up. I think we must stop there for today. Can we hear the last few recitations? I would prefer that we go to the end of the canto. How many passages is it?
Five.
Okay. Yes. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Immobile in herself, she gathered thought. This was the day when Satyavan must die.
Thanks to Sherbindo.